reading sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Pin Show,
the smooth talk of the town.
Cool. Yes, you are. We are back on the Andy Pin Show, and we are going to move on to another topic. We might get back to some of this boring financial bailout stuff, but I got to tell you that, you know, the ratings are dropping like flies. The people are dropping off. When you get talking about this stuff, people's eyes glaze over because it's not easily understandable. There's no good guy and bad guy easily identifiable. It's hell out there. So, what we're going to try is moving on to a civics test. So, there is a civics learning test that has been put out there by ISI, okay? And it's a basic test on American history and the institutions of democracy. And it's 33 questions. And the report just came out recently about how Americans are doing. So I'm going to read you one of the questions, and then we're going to talk about it. So we'll get through some of these questions in this half hour. But here's the first question. The first set of questions are about political history, so we'll go through the first one. Which of the following are the inalienable rights referred to in the Declaration of Independence? And for each question, there are five choices. Now, five choices is harder than four choices in multiple choice. That's why more people miss it. I'm not going to read you each of the five sets of choices, but my guess is you know which of the following are the inalienable rights in the Declaration of Independence, right? It's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The other choices are things like honor, liberty, and peace, liberty, health, and community, life, respect, and equal protection, etc. So, pretty straightforward multiple choice test. It turns out the results are pretty shocking, right? If you consider that out of 33 questions, if you try and see what percentage people get right, you know, it turns out that only 30%, actually a little less than 30%, get a D or above, that is, get 60% of the questions right. In fact, if you consider C to be quality work, and anybody that gets a D or an F is essentially close to failing, 89% of Americans don't know this stuff. They got fewer than 70% right. Only 10%, almost a little less than 11%, could get 70% of these questions right. And they're pretty simple. For example, here's the second question. In 1933, FDR proposed a series of government programs that became known as, well, it's the New Deal, isn't it? The Great Society, the Square Deal, the New Deal, the New Frontier, supply-side economics. I mean, that's a gimme. What are the three branches of government? Right? The fourth question. What was the main issue in the debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas in 1858? Now, admittedly, this is a tough question. I got it right. And by the way, I'll tell you my score later. My percentage. But I got this one right, but a lot of people would miss this, and I understand that. The questions are, so what's the main issue in the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858? A, is slavery morally wrong? B, should slavery be allowed to expand to new territories? C, do southern states have the constitutional right to leave the Union? And D, are free African-American citizens of the United States? Well, since we didn't have the term African-American until Jesse Jackson decided he wanted it about 10 years ago, it can't be that one. The main issue in the Lincoln-Douglas debate, it wasn't, was slavery morally wrong, or did states have the right to leave the Union? It was B, should slavery be allowed to expand in the new territories? If you remember Henry Clay, the great compromiser, he was, by the way, from Lexington, Kentucky, where I used to live. He compromised, he made compromises by getting the Union, the United States, to bring one free state and one slave state into the Union at the same time, keeping the balance of power where it was. Let's try the fifth question, and then we'll go on. The U.S. Electoral College, A, trains those aspiring for higher political office. B, was established to supervise the first televised presidential debates. C, is otherwise known as the U.S. Congress. D, is a constitutionally mandated assembly that elects the president. Or E, was ruled undemocratic by the Supreme Court. Well, as tempting as it is to say, A, that the Electoral College trains those aspiring for higher political office, I think we all know it's D. It's a constitutionally mandated assembly that elects the president. Now, I did a speech right before the election at Toastmasters, and I named it the toughest college in the country. And it was about the Electoral College. So those are the first five questions on this test. And these are all in the general category of political history. But let me go back to the test itself and what's come out of it. Because it turns out that people have shockingly low scores on this test. For example, if you look across the entire country, they had something like 2,000 people take this this year. A sample of people. And the average score is 49%, meaning 33 questions, the average person gets 17 of the questions right. Half of the questions, roughly. It's interesting that there aren't many differences by age. 18 to 24-year-olds get 47% right. But people over 65 only get 46% right. And it's true that the baby boomers, 45 to 64 people, get 52% right. But they're all mostly clustered in the 40s, other than that. So there's no big age difference. There is a little bit of a race difference. There's a little bit of a gender difference. Men do better than women by 7%. There's not much of a difference on marital status. There's not much of a difference on military service, 3%. There's not much of a difference depending on whether you go to church or not. In fact, the more you go to church, the less you know by about 2 to 3% about our history. And there's not much difference on political ideology. Liberal and conservative are nearly the same at 49 and 48%. I wouldn't call that a lead of liberals over conservatives. And moderates are at 51%, so they get a slight lead there. Income is one big discriminator, right? The more money you have, or the more money you earn, the higher score you get on this test. Less than $30,000, people scored 40%. That's well below the mean of 49% on the whole test. Next income bracket, 30 to 50,000, 46%. 50 to 75,000, 51%. And then above 75,000, people get 55% of the questions right. Still, that is shockingly poor. Because it means they only know half the questions. So, the sixth question is about the Bill of Rights. What does the Bill of Rights explicitly prohibit? Prayer in public school? Discrimination based on race, sex, or religion? The ownership of guns by private individuals, establishing an official religion for the United States, or the president from vetoing a line item in a spending bill. Well, if you're well-educated and you keep up with this show, you know that the Bill of Rights explicitly prohibits establishing an official religion for the United States. That's what is known as the Establishment Clause. Congress shall make no law. Number seven. What's the source of the following phrase? Government of the people, by the people, and for the people. You know, on some of these, I didn't have to read the choices. I knew immediately. Is it the I Have a Dream speech, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the Gettysburg Address? Now, for some reason, they only ask four choices on some of these questions. It is, of course, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. He ended with, "The government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth." Question number 8. In 1935 and 1936, the Supreme Court declared that important parts of the New Deal were unconstitutional. President Roosevelt responded by threatening to, I knew immediately what this was, he tried to pack the court, as they say. A, impeach several Supreme Court justices. B, eliminate the Supreme Court. C, appoint additional Supreme Court justices who shared his view. Or D, override the Supreme Court decisions by gaining three-quarters majorities in both houses of Congress. Well, of course, it's trying to appoint additional Supreme Court justices. He wanted to expand the court from 9 members to, I think, 13. And then if he could put 4 more people on the court, people he liked, he could get his way. Well, Congress gave him a lot of leeway, but they did not stand by while he tried to do that. Question number 9. Under our Constitution, some powers belong to the federal government. What is one power of the federal government? And then it goes on to list them. I'm not going to go through every one of these questions. Number 10 is name one freedom guaranteed by the First Amendment. Number 11 is what impact did the Anti-Federalists have on the United States Constitution? And this is the only question that I missed out of 33. I got 32 out of 33 for something like 98.some%. Right. And I was looking at the numbers. So less than 1% of people got 90%, meaning they got less than 30. Less than 1% of people got 30 of 33 right. And I got 32 of 33. But I missed this one, and boy, does it torque me off. What impact did the Anti-Federalists have on the U.S. Constitution? Now, you have to think about what Anti-Federalists are. The Federalists believe in a federal government, meaning states' rights. So it's kind of counterintuitive, but the Federalists believed in strong rights of the states. You protect the rights of the states and reserve the rights to the states, except as enumerated in the Constitution, that are explicitly granted to the federal government. So the Anti-Federalists are people who believe in a strong central government, or believe in the central government having certain powers. So, what impact did the Anti-Federalists have on the United States Constitution? Number 11, the one I missed. A, their arguments helped lead to the adoption of the Bill of Rights. B, their arguments helped lead to the abolition of the slave trade. C, their influence ensured that the federal government would maintain a standing army. And D, their influence ensured that the federal government would have the power to tax. I knew that it wasn't going to come to the tax, and I knew it wasn't about slavery. But I guessed, C, that their influence ensured that the federal government would maintain a standing army, because I knew that a standing army was a concern for people back then. But it turns out I was wrong. It's, in fact, that the Anti-Federalists helped lead to the adoption of the Bill of Rights. And that's the one I missed. Oh, well. Well, that's the first. Well, let me finish the political questions, and then we'll go on. Question 12. Which of the following statements is true about abortion? Well, this is a more recent issue, right? It was legal in most states in the 1960s. The Supreme Court struck down most legal restrictions on it in Roe v. Wade. C, the Supreme Court ruled in Plessy versus Ferguson that underage women must notify their parents of an impending abortion. D, the National Organization for Women has lobbied for legal restrictions on it. Or E, it is currently legal only in cases of rape or incest or to protect the life of the mother. Well, this should be pretty obvious to you. Let's use the process of elimination. It was legal in most states until 1960. No, the Roe v. Wade decision came in 1973, and that's what legalized abortion in most states. Actually, in all states. And that makes B the answer. The Supreme Court struck down most legal restrictions on it in Roe v. Wade. It wasn't about parental notification. Obviously, that's a current issue. National Organization of Women would never lobby for restrictions on it, we don't think. And it's not legal only in cases of rape or incest or to protect the life of the mother. And then the final question, the 13th question about political history. is an interesting one. And not every American would get this because it borders on philosophy. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and Aquinas would concur that. Now, of course, we're talking three giants of Greek philosophy and St. Thomas Aquinas, a Middle Ages Christian or Catholic theologian and philosopher. So what would they all agree on? Greek philosophers and Catholic philosopher from hundreds of years ago would concur that, A, all moral and political truth is relative to one's time and place. Moral ideas are best explained as material accidents or byproducts of evolution. Values originating in one's conscience cannot be judged by others. Christianity is the only one true religion and should rule the state. And E, certain permanent moral and political truths are accessible to human reason. Well, of course, it's E. The rest of that's a very postmodern or close to postmodern, and that it would not be what we would expect from Thomas Aquinas or the Greeks. All right, well, we'll come back and do the cultural institutions a little bit later. But in the meantime, we need to talk about angry people.
Look at all the angry people. Look at all the angry people. Richard B. Cheney swears that Pat lay in public like so much hot air. And Sissy in Bush care, waits for the weapons, still thinks Iraq was a threat to the U.S. homeland. I can't understand all the Bush appointees. Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Rabbit and Coulter, writing the words to a book that reflects a strange fear. Who would come near, look at her whining, blaming opponents and damning up dubious foes? Is it for show, all the right-wing parrots? Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Look at all the angry people. Look at all the angry people. Ambassador Bolton hates the UN, but now he is a part of it all. He's got some gall, push the divider, renominates rival judges, no change in his tone. And he's not alone, all the angry people, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong?
Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today is November 24th, 2008. And on this day, D.B. Cooper jumped out of a Northwestern Airlines plane over the state of Washington with a $200,000 ransom, and he was never heard from again. Now they found some of the money, and they suspect he died, but nobody knows for sure. He never was caught. One of the few successful hijackings that the person didn't get caught and prosecuted, because it's pretty hard once you hijack an airplane to get away. But he managed to do it, and it was pretty amazing. And it was on this date in 1859 that Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species, the book that started it all. You know, there are three great discoveries in modernity that really stand out. I mean, you know, there's Galileo and Copernicus and the idea that the Earth is not the center of the universe. That was a rude awakening for most people. But the three biggies are, and I'll put them in order in which they occurred, are Darwin, because he changed how we looked at animals versus man, and we realized that man was an animal after evolution. That's the thing I think that bothers religious people about evolution, because they've spent a lot of time insisting that man is not an animal and can separate his animal instincts and sublimate them. But if we're animals like the other animals, we've got that streak in us we can never totally tame, which of course is true. The second great discovery was by Sigmund Freud, the discovery of the unconscious, that we do things and we aren't even aware of the motivations for them at times. And it was the birth of the field of psychology. And then the third is Einstein and the theory of relativity, and turned our view of the universe upside down by saying that time is not a constant. And it made people question everything they thought they understood about the world as you look at it. It's not always obvious what's going on. So Darwin started it with The Origin of Species on this date in 1859. Do you realize that will be 150 years next year? And of course, at the Republican debates this election season, 30% of the Republican candidates raised their hand when asked if they did not believe in evolution. So I understand Abraham Lincoln not believing in evolution. The book was just published 2 years before he became president. And I understand James Garfield or Teddy Roosevelt not believing in evolution. And we got to the Scopes monkey trial in 1925, and I get that a lot of people were still upset about the idea of evolution. But my gosh, man, this is 2008. The idea that people are out there saying we should teach both sides, or that somehow there's an alternative to evolution. No, there's no alternative. No. There's only one model out there that accounts for the data. They could throw evolution out tomorrow. And there's no theory to replace it, because there's no other theory that accounts for the data that we see. Millions of pieces of data in the rock strata and in the animal kingdom, in the fossils, in the genome, all of it points to evolution. Enough about Charles Darwin. Let us return to those thrilling days of yesteryear. Actually, I should point out a few people who were born on this day, on November 24th, before we get out of here. It's the birthday of a couple of musicians, Pete Best, known as the Fifth Beatle, and Donald Duck Dunn. He was with Booker T and the MGs, but also was made famous in the Blues Brothers movie. Heck of a musician. William F. Buckley was born on this date in 1925. Of course, he died just a couple of years ago. Dale Carnegie was born on November 24th. Scott Joplin was born on November 24th. Toulouse-Lautrec. President Zachary Taylor, going back quite a ways. And finally, Bat Masterson. He was a real character. You know, they made a TV show out of him in the 50s. But he was born in 1853. All right, let's go back for the last couple of minutes here to ISI's college rankings survey. So their 2008 survey is out on civics. And basically, you can go, if you want to read about this, you go to www.americancivicliteracy.org. That's americancivicliteracy.org. And you can take the quiz yourself. And you can download the entire report. But basically, they got the 2008 version is out now, but the 2007 college rankings aren't done yet. I mean, 2008 college rankings aren't done yet, but the 2007 college rankings are. Now, I don't care for how they ranked it, because they ranked it by which college had the most value added. Okay, meaning which students change the most. When you take freshmen, the average for the freshmen and the average for the seniors, the biggest difference, they're interpreting it as that's the college that added the most value. All right. So it's schools like Eastern Connecticut State University, Marion College, Murray State in Kentucky, Concordia University, St. Cloud State. And they get a difference of between 8 and 9, 8.5 to 9.5 points, percentage points. That is, freshmen only know something between 35 and 45% of these. And then by the time they're seniors, when they evaluate seniors, they know 8 to 10% more. But that's not the way to look at this, that this is the value added of the college. Right, because wouldn't you think that Harvard and Yale in those schools would add more value than these smaller schools? But look at the bottom 50. I mean, of the 50, look at the bottom of the top 50. It's Cornell, Yale, starting up from 50. Cornell, Yale, Duke, St. John's in New York, Princeton, Rutgers, University of Cal, Berkeley, right? Oakwood College in Alabama, surprisingly. All of these, their people don't actually get any smarter. There's actually a small negative in terms of what they seem to know. Well, that the negative doesn't really count, but the University of Virginia, George Mason appear next to each other here. And basically, there's a tiny gain for freshmen versus seniors. Here's the explanation. If you're smart enough to get into Princeton or Yale or Duke, or even smart enough to get into University of Virginia or George Mason, you won't find that college helps you that much in terms of answering these 33 questions. You go up a couple of percentage points, but not much. But if you get into Eastern Connecticut State or Marion College or Murray State, you'll find that 4 years of college will bump your score up 8 to 10 percentage points. That doesn't say that value added is the college is such a great college. It means the quality of the people coming in, they have a lot of room to learn things. And what's shocking here is these percentages. For example, I was interested to find out that University of Virginia, the incoming freshmen score 63% on this. And outgoing seniors score 65.5%. So it's only 2.5% difference. George Mason, incoming freshmen, score 47% on this civics test. And they go out at about 50%. So a little less than 3% percentage points gain. But they are 15, 16 points behind University of Virginia students, which is kind of depressing. Anyway, we've got time, maybe, for one more question. No, you know, we don't actually. We're going to end it up here. I will just say some of the questions on the rest of the test are things like, who is the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military? And, of course, you have five choices, but the answer is the president. Name two countries that were our enemy during World War II. Again, it's a multiple-choice question. You got to be able to notice that Germany and Japan are there, and that's the obvious choice. So it's not that hard a test, and the average American scores just under 50%. We need to teach our citizens more. We're expecting them to go to the polls and make the right decisions. They screwed it up in 2000 and 2004, and we're reaping the benefits now. So something's got to be done here. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. In any case, somehow Americans made the right decision this time, and we will have a thoughtful president who may be able to get us out of some of the messes that the Bush administration has created. In any case, that'll do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. I will be back next Monday. Until then, go to andyfinn.us to read and weep. And until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.